I'm 54 years old. Today is Thursday, July 30th, 2020. My home city is Alexandria, Virginia, but today I'm in Bethany Beach, Delaware, and I'm speaking with Matthew, OSS partner.
And my name is Matthew Hurt. I'm 33 years old. Today is Thursday, July 30th, 2020. I just moved to New Orleans, Louisiana from Arlington, Virginia. And Barbara is my OSS partner.
Now you can do the bio.
Okay. Matthew, would you like to start first or?
I'm comfortable with that. I can do that.
Okay, please.
So I was born in outside Nashville, Tennessee, in a suburban community called Murfreesboro. It is in one of the fastest growing counties in Tennessee. I grew up in a two-parent household with a younger sister. My sister didn't decide to go to college. I was the one who excelled in school primarily, was in the gifted program all through K through 12. And went to the local university, Middle Tennessee State University, because I wanted to be a teacher. I got involved in a lot of campus activities at the time. I wrote for the school newspaper, had a radio show on campus, was involved in student government. My parents were both apolitical and not particularly religious. However, I grew up Southern Baptist, an influence from a friend of mine's great-grandmother who would pick us up all the neighbor kids on Sunday and take us to church. Somewhere along the way in college, it was a small church and there was an internal disagreement. And I said, you know, life is too stressful to add this into the mix and stopped attending. Was involved in politics on campus and then got involved in conservative politics right about the time Tennessee was flipping from conservative Democrat to conservative Republican. In the legislature. Graduated in 2009 with a degree in history and political science and immediately moved to Arlington, Virginia to work with conservative college students across the country. For the last 11 or 12 years or so, I have been organizing groups on campus or in communities that was originally for conservative causes primarily, but increasingly it's for causes like criminal justice reform, issues surrounding poverty, issues of community strengthening and building. It's one of the reasons why in the middle of this coronavirus pandemic that I decided to move to New Orleans and continue on that path. Three interesting political points. I ran for local office at the age of 19 at the urging of members of my church community. I came within 92 votes of defeating a 16-year incumbent. And I was a Ron Paul supporting delegate to the Republican National Convention in Tampa in 2012. And I jokingly said I was the one Ben Carson delegate to the Republican National Convention in 2016. However, the background on both of those is that I was part of the insurgent grassroots group that was trying to disrupt what appeared to be the status quo or what was going to happen. So in 2012, it was a rules fight against the Romney machine. And in 2016, it was a Ted Cruz-aligned fight against the Trump campaign, primarily involved in Republican politics. But I just registered to vote in Orleans Parish, Louisiana, yesterday, and I registered with no party affiliation. Okay. I am passionate at the local level about local solutions and identifying ways community groups, civic institutions can solve the problems beyond government, and would consider myself a small L libertarian.
Okay. All right, I will go. Again, my name is Barbara. I think I see, I've been taking lots of copious notes. That's what I do. I'm a writer, so I take notes as I go. That'll keep me engaged in our conversation back and forth. First of all, thank you, Matthew, for agreeing to do this. I find these kind of conversations fascinating, which is what made me become aligned and get involved with Make America Dinner Again when I heard about it, and did one of their dinners. So I'd love to talk to you more about that as the conversation goes along. Backstory on myself, raised in rural Pennsylvania, about 3.5 hours north of Washington, D.C., and grew up in a labor democratic political family. I thought it was really interesting. One of the questions said, when's the first time you ever heard about politics? And I can't exactly remember the first time because it's something that was always discussed in my home. My family was Christian. My mom was Methodist. My dad actually grew up worshiping at home. So that was something. He was on a small working family farm in rural America, rural Pennsylvania, one of nine. And my mom was one of five on a small farm. They grew up about 15 minutes from each other. And our house was on my paternal grandparents' farm. So I always grew up in the country. And I like to say it was a great place to be until you got to be in about middle school. And when you were a teenager, you were bored out of your gourd. And so there was absolutely nothing to do other than go in the back of the cornfield and drink on the weekends and hope that you didn't get caught by anybody. And so when I, my dad was somebody who really suffered the effects of globalization, jobs moving off, you know, like he lost his job. We lived in coal country. We lived near a plant that was a byproduct of the steel mills in Pittsburgh. And so very Rust Belt effects coming out to the rural part of the state. So kind of south central to western Pennsylvania. And I can remember sitting in my grandmother's living room, and back then kids were to be seen and not heard, which is a quite different way than my husband and I are raising our daughter. She is me at the age of 14, and I must have been exhausting to my parents. So she has an opinion on everything. And getting back to when I was that age, I remember sitting in my grandmother's living room. She was a huge Clinton supporter. My dad was just, I vote Democratic all the time. His sisters were Ross Perot supporters. Whoever the other candidate was, it was, who was running against Clinton the first time? I'm like at a loss right now, but just these political conversations were constantly taking place, and I found it really fascinating. And so, you know, political advice from my dad was just vote blue. Just when you go, just vote blue. And I got interested in politics probably not, I mean, I always had opinions on things, but wasn't really interested until after I got out of school. I went to journalism school, have my undergraduate and my master's degree. My parents were people who had a high school diploma, so college was really important to my dad, especially after seeing he didn't take the GI Bill benefits when he came out of Korea, and he really, you know, saw what a high school diploma did to limit him in later on in life. So the message from a really early age was education, education, education. And I said, I want to be a journalist. And they were like, okay, but not that. So it's very funny that, you know, my sister got a business degree. She went into business. My other sister got a nursing degree. She became a nurse. My brother chose not to go to school. He's a self-employed business owner now, but he's really struggled with not having a college degree and living still back in rural Pennsylvania. But I always described myself as the kid that they didn't really know what to do with. I was very opinionated, argued with my parents about politics all the time. Exactly. I have the child that I deserve now. And I got a journalism, my master's in journalism from Temple University in Philadelphia. And I really thought that I wanted to move back home and live in our rural community. I just didn't realize what living in that big of a city had done to change me in the 2 short years I was there. So I had this amazing opportunity to work for a small Head Start program in rural Pennsylvania. And I saw very much how federal dollars and federal policymaking influenced local decision making. So, you know, Matthew, getting back to your work at the local level and what you're interested in doing, I'd love to talk to you more about that. my opportunities were really limited in rural Pennsylvania. So I started looking for jobs in the Washington, D.C. area. And I made connections through a rural leadership program that I had been accepted into that was funded by the state government in Pennsylvania to train and equip rural people to be leaders in their local communities. And that program really just opened up a whole world for me. And about a month after I started looking for jobs in DC, I was hired as a lobbyist for a rural family service organization called the National Grange. I am probably one of the worst lobbyists that ever existed because, you know, when I would go into somebody's office and I would advocate for rural education, rural economic development, and someone would say, yeah, we're not doing that. I was like, okay, well, thanks. Have a good day. And fortunately, I went into, they allowed me at that job to use my communications PR background. And so I became a director of communications and worked for a series of national nonprofit organizations for my whole career until my daughter was in kindergarten. And I quit and I opened my own communications PR shop. And so I would say that I have been a lifelong Democrat. As the party has evolved, I've evolved with it. Our tent just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, that's kind of hard sometimes to get people to coalesce. But I would say I probably identify as center left, too progressive, but I'm someone who really feels committed to compromise. So I think that's it for me.
Okay. So 50 minutes is going to go by really fast. So you just try to stay on target. So the next question's in there. If one of you could ask it to the other and then vice versa, and I'll put in the next one as you get close to the end.
Okay. Okay. So Matthew, I would love to learn about someone who's been kindest to you in your life.
You know, this is this is actually a really challenging question to answer. I grew up in a conservative community, and one of my first ever political mentors was a conservative state representative who, near the end of her time in the General Assembly, the man with whom she was married came out of the closet. And they were very close political and personal mentors of mine. I worked on her campaign in 2006, and as their, you know, as the realization that he was living, you know, life as a gay man was coming to light, she left him, you know, rightfully so, I imagine, and so did his entire or many people in the political community around him, sort of abandoned him. And it was right at the time as I was, you know, facing graduation from university. And I was one of the, is my understanding, I was one of the few people who stuck with him and maintained a friendship. And I look back over the last 14 years of our friendship, and I've seen him, you know, find a partner with whom he can share his life. They are both hardcore Trump supporters, and they have provided many, many personal and professional and political opportunities for me. You know, my parents have always been there for me, and they are fantastic parents, doing everything they could do to support my sister and I. But in addition to that, that infrastructure of a political mentor and someone that I could trust in this gentleman, you know, I look back, and even in a couple of weeks I'll be traveling back home, and I will ultimately go and visit with them and stay with them rather than staying at my parents' house just because it's hectic. So, you know, the opportunities and the kindness that he has shown over the last 14 years, it's really been a meaningful friendship and mentorship for me. And so I would ask you, Barbara, you know, tell me about someone in your life who has been kindest to you.
Oh, I would say probably my Sunday school teacher. When I was in kind of the teenage young adults group at our rural United Methodist Church, I don't think I ever heard Thelma Davis speak above a whisper. She always had kindness, just all of her actions, And I really think about that in terms of, I still choose to affiliate with the United Methodist Church, but it's a lot more liberal and progressive than the one that I grew up in with the, when it comes to the theology. But she just was kindness personified. And I just felt everything I was struggling through as a teenager in my own family with, you know, really trying to figure out who I was and not having a really good relationship with my dad at the time. She was just this safe place to go that was always love and kindness. And she has always personified for me when I think about people who I say embody the teachings of Jesus. That's who she was. So Matthew, next question is your earliest memory of politics.
You know, I think my earliest memory of politics was I ran for vice president, student council in fifth grade. But I don't think that I'm going to reframe the question. I think the most meaningful early memory in politics was growing up in the Southern Baptist Church. A gentleman who's now a pastor by the name of Terry Frazier used to impress upon me the wisdom and teachings of Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh. And I knew that the fiscal policies were right where I wanted to be, but there was something amiss about some of those. Mm-hmm. And I discovered a gentleman by the name of Clarence, who owned a small business right about that time, gave me a copy of Frederick Bastiat's The Law, which illustrates sort of what I believe to be the proper role of government to protect citizens from plunder, either from government or from our neighbors. And it was in there that I said, you know, this is really the cornerstone of my political philosophy, is this notion that individuals exist to work in concert and in congregation with one another, to work together to solve problems, and we establish government to prevent us from harming one another, but increasingly government uses its power to harm us. And so that is probably the cornerstone of my political philosophy, and it's the most meaningful early political memory. So I'd ask, you know, what is your earliest memory of politics growing up in a home where, you know, labor and voting was so important?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it really is for me, my earliest memories of being at my paternal grandmother's house. My paternal grandfather died when I was about 4 years old. So, and my dad, and his family decided, they were very religious, and I would say very conservative, on the conservative side of Christianity. But my grandfather had chosen to start this kind of worship service at home, which was really weird to me as a kid, because my mom and dad had an agreement that she would marry my dad if she didn't have to go to home church. And so it was, if we have kids, I'm raising them in the Methodist church. And so on Sundays, we split ways. But in the afternoon, sometimes we would go to that grandmother's house. And I just remember all the adults talking politics, my aunts, my uncles, my grandmother. She was the biggest Bill Clinton supporter I think I've ever met. She lived to be 94 years old. She lived through his first term. I miss her every day, but I'm glad she didn't live to see Bill Clinton's second term. So, because that would have broken her heart. But she was always watching C-SPAN, she was watching CNN, or she was antiquing. And so it was just politics was always part of that kind of extended family circle. So I'm curious, Matthew, why did you want to do this interview today?
That's a great question, and it actually goes back to your comments about Make America Dinner Again. You know, like you, I'm really over sort of the hyperpartisan rhetoric, primarily, you know, pushed out through cable news and the headlines. And what I found living in primarily liberal communities, you know, I just moved from Arlington, where 83% of people voted for Hillary Clinton. I did not. Mm-hmm. And so when trying to craft a policy majority, I knew that there had to be compromise and that I had to listen to different viewpoints in a way that, where we could find commonality. One of the things that you mentioned is I believe your father's service in Korea. My paternal grandfather actually served and died in Korea. He was listed, classified as missing in action. And my grandmother, in her letters, I've seen her letters to the Department of the Army, you know, where she's asking about the whereabouts of PFC Albert Hurt. And I can't imagine what it was like for her to be, you know, unknowing about where her husband was, and she never remarried. So my dad grew up as the only child to a single mother, a widow of war. And I think about the early days of the Iraq War, and my grandmother would just cry and cry and cry because she knew what was, you know, many of those men and women would not return home to their spouses. And so it's in the humanity, in the humanization of public policy, putting a face to the harms and the helpfulness that we can experience on both sides, and figuring out those solutions based on our commonality and working through differences. I just don't think that at the national level we can have a discussion that leads to you know, reasonable solutions and compromises. And so that's why I'm engaged in Make America Dinner Again, and StoryCorps, and Braver Angels, and in any of these outfits, any of these efforts to bring people to the table. Why did you want to participate in this interview today?
Very similar reasons. I think that I can remember, because I'm old enough, when I came to Washington, D.C., that there were moderate Democrats, conservative Democrats, the Blue Dogs, and there were moderate and liberal Republicans. And I remember how policy was debated, legislated, bills, then there were, you know, compromises that were put together. And I just feel that we have a system right now that we have the extremes of both sides. We have the far left, we have the far right. We have so much polarization. And it's toxic, right? I mean, I think about my immediate family. They argued and fought vociferously for their own beliefs. I mean, you know, my aunt who said she was going to support Ross Perot, and I thought my grandmother was going to, you know, excommunicate her from the family for doing that, but they didn't, you know? I mean, they were family and they loved each other. They had differences of opinion and they could argue respectfully. And when I first came to Washington, D.C. and worked for the agriculture community. So I went from the nation's smallest, which was the National Grange, to the largest, American Farm Bureau Federation. And I was editor of their weekly newspaper, which was widely read on Capitol Hill because agriculture is a huge policy. And I just remember, you know, going to those committee hearings. And I just, over the years, just saw those middles disappearing. And so the center doesn't seem, we don't seem to have a political center anymore. And so I just really believe in compromise. I mean, I believe that people should fight very vociferously for what they believe and the causes that are important to them. But I think when it comes time to actually get something done for the American people, we should have a representative democracy where we actually compromise. And I think that's become like a four-letter word, right? It's just become, nobody wants to compromise anymore. Everybody just wants what they want. And so to do this interview is really, for me, I don't like how I think my friends group is overwhelmingly liberal, progressive, feminist, although I think everybody should be a feminist, but that's a whole other conversation. But, you know, I've really struggled over the last 4 years to watch what happens in conversations online. And that's why I really like to Make America Dinner Again, because I feel in such a short time, we've lost the ability to have debate respectfully, to listen to each other, to see each other as human beings first versus political enemies. It's scary to me. I don't like that. I really think it's a dangerous thing to have happen. And I think gerrymandering contributes to it. And so I want to be part of a solution versus a problem, I guess.
You're on your own unless you need me to put in a question.
Okay. So, Matthew, I will ask you, for me, I mean, I've seen this happening. It's not just the last 4 years, right? It's not just since the November election. I've seen this happening over the course of my time in DC, that the conversations have gotten more toxic. You mentioned cable news. I don't watch cable news at all. I refuse. I just think everybody is a commentator, not a journalist anymore. So what do you feel, contributes to all this toxicity in our political life? And what do you think is going to turn it around? Can it be turned around? Is it an easy or hard thing?
So I'm the I'm the kid in the room full of horse manure saying there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. And so I'm the eternal optimist. I think that a major contributing factor, and it's a double-edged sword, is the proliferation of social media. I think that dehumanizes us, or it allows us to easily dehumanize one another, because we are behind computer screens and the other person is an avatar or somebody that we don't have to face in person. That's why I think, events like Make America Dinner Again, like this one and others, are so important, because it is incredibly hard to say something acerbic or nasty to someone that you are sitting in front of, especially someone who you know something about them on a personal level before you dig into the political. And so I largely refrain from engaging in political discourse online. And in fact, most of my if I wade into something, it is usually lighthearted trolling where I poke fun at all sides, and just because I don't think there are productive conversations online. For example, I used to write for a local news site in Arlington that is very well read, read widely in the community. And one of my first columns was about a county board member who'd engaged in some unethical activity. And one of his former campaign staffers took to Twitter and just started attacking me and tweeting at the outlet and saying what a terrible author I was, even though what I'd written was solid. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to engage in this. Let's meet. This was before coronavirus, last November, last December. Let's meet at a watering hole. And let's get to know one another. And we met at a place in Clarendon, a bar where the owner is an Irish immigrant who, it has been easier for him to become a restaurant owner than an American citizen. So that is a about our immigration policy. And me and this young man sat and at the end, we didn't agree on everything, but he actually tweeted out a selfie of us, over drinks saying, I don't agree with this guy, but he makes some good points, and he's a genuine person. And so I think that's something that I want to turn those online conversations into in-person conversations, because I think that's where we have the greatest opportunity to, one, understand where the other person is coming from, and two, figure out our views based on nuanced information. It's not wrong to change your mind if you get new information about something. And so I think we see that more frequently in person. I'm happy to toss that question back to you. I'm excited.
What was
about
the original question?
it was three parts. What contributes to the sort of heightened polarization? I said social media is a big contributor. And do you see a way to sort of work through that and solve it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely. I think I would say, looking at what's happened to journalism, I look to how the people who create the news and push how content is pushed out. I think social media, absolutely, the algorithms, that if you like something on Facebook, for example, then you're just going to get so much more content that aligns with that. And I do think being behind a screen is kind of the It's the online version of aggressive driving. You know, you can be obnoxious behind your car, where you wouldn't do that necessarily to somebody. You know, you wouldn't stalk somebody and walk right up behind them, but you do that with your car, right? If you don't think they're doing what they should be doing. And I think online, it is really, it's just so easy to reduce each other to a soundbite. But I do look at, you know, I don't like what's happened with journalism. And I think it goes to when the internet came along, newspapers were not prepared to have a financially sound model to transition into. And so now it's clickbait headlines, and it's a rush to get a story out because it's more important to be first than it is necessarily to have the facts. I've really tried to force myself to read a variety of media instead of just have my one lens. But I would probably say public radio and public broadcasting are my two go-to sources for news consumption. But I've been consuming something every weekend and every day. It's an online newsletter called The Dispatch. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And that's more center-right. People like David French, I don't know if you know who that is, and he's been involved in that. And so I just really try and force myself. I get really frustrated when I see people on the far left of my friend circle, as well as those on the far left, put stuff up, and it's like, come on. You know, we can't blow up every single second of every single day. You're an optimist, I'm a pessimist. So I anticipate any and all worst case scenarios. And then if the things don't go as bad as I think they will, then I'm always pleasantly surprised. So my husband is the optimist. And so we balance each other out. So I was like talking to optimists like you, because I'm much more pessimistic about things. But have you heard about Ezra Klein's book, Why We're Polarized? He's the guy who helped start Vox. I really want to read that book, because really looking into all the social media platforms and the algorithms and kind of like they're part of why we're so polarized.
There's also a report called the Hidden Tribes Report.
I need to write that down.
Yeah, that breaks us out into six or seven categories across the political spectrum, and our level of engagement in public discourse, and how we've grouped ourselves into these tribes. And it's, you know, it's the same reason we like the football teams that we like, or we like the authors that we like. It's belonging to a community, but particularly in this place where many people in politics believe it's a zero-sum game, that if I win, you lose, then there's no room for compromise. And especially if you think that your political opponent is your enemy, then it's much harder to say, well, I can work together with my enemy on something. So I guess I should, unless you want to add, I guess I should ask maybe the next question to be fair. Yes. Mm-hmm. Is there an issue that you've evolved on, or you've gained more information and maybe not changed your mind, but you've sharpened your position on an issue over time?
I mean, I think my political beliefs are my core political beliefs are probably the same as they've always been, but I think what I've come to understand is how something may work for me living in suburban, urban Northern Virginia is not necessarily something that's going to work for rural, remote areas. And so I think about zip code politics a lot. I think about taxation and fiscal policy. Probably the biggest issue for me is I built the bulk of my professional career serving as a national communications director for national advocacy nonprofit organizations was in public education. And so, I am somebody who I'm not a proponent of school choice and vouchers. I am a proponent of charter schools. So I think that's really been something that's been interesting within my party, you know, who it's kind of like your purity test is you have to say you're 100% for public education. And I say, well, charter schools are part of public education. And I find that a really difficult conversation to have with a lot of Democratic friends. I see what happened in education as an evolution of what's happened in our society. We are a country, a nation of people who like choices, right? So so now we're going to tell everybody in this, everybody gets to pick whatever they want for dinner. Everybody gets to, you know, pick what they want to consume on TV, where they want to go. Now you have to just pick the local public school. I do worry about siphoning dollars away from our schools that are in desperate, you know, like the kids who can't go to a charter school or can't go to a private or parochial school, for example, because they have a single mom who works in one direction and their school is in another. So I think about equity issues. Like, I just think education, I grew up in a rural area. There was only a local school. There was nothing else. There was no choice. And now there's so many options. And that works for people who really know how to use the system and have resources. But does it really work for the people who are stuck with, you get what you get? So I really wish there was a way to reform education in a more equitable way. I just always get really sad and frustrated when I think about highly educated families, even if they don't have the economic resources, they find a way. You know, you were in a gifted and talented program. Our daughter was identified for that as well. So it was like, even in our local public schools, doors have been opened for her that aren't open for the gen ed kids. So I think it comes down to, for me, is I'm willing to listen to solutions, but I'm kind of the person who says, like, for this democracy to work, it has to work for the people who don't have connections, who don't have money, who don't have the resources. And that's where I just feel like, it's, that is frustrating to me. That, I don't know if that's an answer to your question, though, necessarily.
I think that like sharpens, you know, you found a place where you've explored elements of what wouldn't be the orthodoxy for your, you know, for your political persuasion. So I think that that falls into the category.
I'm curious about something with you. You made the move to New Orleans, and so you grew up in Murfreesboro, and then you moved to Arlington, and now you're back in New Orleans. You may have said this earlier, but what made you make that move?
I would say, you know, one of the 45% of the reason I moved to New Orleans is probably coronavirus. I think I was previously in a position for a nonprofit educational foundation where I was public facing, the director of external relations. Well, in the last 4 months, we haven't had external relations. We haven't had conferences. We haven't, you know, my travel schedule was 80% travel across the country. You know, every week I was in a different city, and that all came to a halt in mid-March. And so it allowed me to really consider, you know, consider where I was in my life and where I am in this organization. I'm at the same organization I was at before the pandemic started, but understanding our management philosophy and our corporate philosophy, such as it is, I knew that I had to take a leadership role somewhere. And I told myself if I moved out of the DC area, I would move to one of two places, Portland, Oregon, or New Orleans, Louisiana. I feel like I've always thrived in progressive communities, even with holding the philosophy that I have and being involved. I think one of the challenges here is is I live in a predominantly deep South African American community, which mm-hmm. is different than any other place, even different than most, you know. Arlington is not a majority African American community, most of Northern Virginia. And so what are the, so to speak, what are the cultural or tribal politics of New Orleans that may help me or may inhibit me from getting involved in local politics here? I'm very interested in figuring that out. And it was about time for a challenge. I'd sort of for the last year or so been on autopilot in the last job. It came so easy that I didn't, it wasn't fulfilling to the extent that it could have been anymore. And so I immediately jumped into this about a month ago, and I have been, it's been a challenge every day, and it's been awesome. And I've had to adjust obviously to the tropical temperature we have here. So,
So I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so I would say that's, you know, about half the pandemic and other elements are just looking for a challenge and looking to move up. I think that I'm able to articulate a philosophy that I have through my employer. And you know, people ask, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I say, solving these problems in a different place. And so I'm very happy to, and I made the conscious decision to move to Orleans Parish in the city to be a voter and a taxpayer and a decision maker in the city, rather than living in the suburbs where most of my, you know, traditional white conservative or libertarian counterparts call home.
I find it fascinating, the comment that you made about really choosing to be in a progressive area. And that was really interesting to me, because I think if the reverse were true for me, I don't know how I would feel being, I don't know how I would feel right now with the state of things being a progressive Democrat in a really conservative Republican area, like where I grew up. I think, you know, what the vote in Arlington in 2016 for Clinton was the vote for Trump where I grew up. And so I have a lot of my friends who are Democrats that I grew up with who are really struggling there. They feel like they've lost friends. They don't feel like they have anybody they can talk to anymore. So even like they're really struggling right now. So I commend you for that. I mean, I think that's really interesting that you chose to move somewhere where you knew that you would find people with very different political beliefs than you. And the decision to move to Portland, Oregon. Are you glad right now that you're in New Orleans, or would you rather be in Portland given what's going on there?
So I actually love small D Democratic protest movements. So in Arlington, I participated in the Black Lives Matter protests, but my most recent past protest before that was I was tear gassed in Barcelona on the Friday after the Spanish government imprisoned or sentenced Catalan politicians.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So I got a little too close to law enforcement, and the cops in Spain, if you think cops in New York or in Portland or federal authorities are bad, the cops in Spain don't care at all. So I was actually, imprisoned is a little bit hyperbolic, but I was locked into a bar two nights in a row in Barcelona. I took part in, or I at least visited Occupy Wall Street in both Zuccotti Park and Freedom Plaza in New York and DC in 2010. I was involved in the Tea Party protests, before that. I've always been fascinated with grassroots movements and on the left or right, and have always participated in them, at least as an observer. And so that's something I'm the guy with spare poster board in my apartment in case there's a protest that breaks out. So
I love it. I've lost count the number of protests I've been to. I'm sure you're shocked to hear that, but the number of protests I've been to in the last 4 years. So,
And I was at the Women's March in January, and my big thing is so how do you turn unrest or frustration into political action? And that's always my the way I process these movements is, okay, what actionable items can you turn these into to create policy solutions?
So what do you think? What do you think about that moving forward right now? I mean, I feel there's a protest a day in DC in the last 4 years. So in every major city right now, there have been protests a day for how many weeks? Do you feel? I guess I'm curious. You are an optimist, so looking at everything that's happening, do you feel hopeful about all of this? All of the protests and what's happening, do you feel hopeful about where we can take our democracy moving forward?
Yeah, I think the solutions right now it's around Black Lives Matter and what are the policy solutions around overcriminalization, policing, due process, sentencing and reentry. Those are the five sort of themes of the criminal justice system. And I think more and more increasingly, Republicans and Democrats are working together. You know, we've seen it at the federal level with the First Step Act, which passed overwhelmingly in both chambers and the president signed. We've seen it in red states and blue states. You know, Texas started a trend in the mid-2000s where they started closing prisons and reforming the criminal justice system. And I'm in a place where Louisiana has one of the most antiquated criminal justice systems with one of the most harsh prisons in the country, where most of those incarcerated are African Americans. You know, where can we find solutions when in a state where there is such stark racial contrast? You know, on the I-10 corridor from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, and then the more white communities in the suburbs and north. Where are their policy solutions? And I think for the most part, politicians on both sides of the aisle are willing to work together. However, you know, what are the problems with the red team not giving the blue team a win and vice versa? So we have to be mindful of that. In Louisiana, it's a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor. You know, there is bipartisanship, but not if they're going to allow the other team to get a win before Election Day. So, you know, working through that is challenging. Mm-hmm. I don't have another question. So Amy, if you've got one ready to go that I could ask, sure. That'll probably put us right at time.
So basically there's one that's, what are transformative moments in your life that inform your politics? That's a possibility. Or you can, see if there's something that you just talked about that you differ on, because you seem to be agreeing on a lot of things. Is there anything that you differ on that you want to talk about?
I bet there's a lot we differ on.
Well, that's one of the things that I do is I try to find commonality first, and it makes it easier to disagree. But I'm interested in your friend group and how are other of your friends who consider themselves liberal or progressive, are they actively, and it's hard in Northern Virginia, are they actively seeking opportunities to either entertain other viewpoints or engage with people with whom they don't agree?
I shouldn't speak for them, but I know when it comes to social media, I have a lot of people who have quote unquote sanitized their friends group. So, you know, I didn't do that. I mean, I think in the whole history of having Facebook, I've maybe unfriended two people, just cause I was just like, you can't post that stuff. And I don't like to, like, the stuff that you post is really awful. And so I don't want to see that. And so, you know, now we have unfollow, so it's much more polite. Right. But, I don't know. I mean, I am the person who I sometimes feel like I'm swimming upstream when I talk about compromise. I mean, it's been with who we are going to get out of the slate of candidates for the Democratic nominee. And if you were a Pete Buttigieg, you know, supporter or a Biden supporter, you were called a corporate Democrat by the progressives and the Democratic Socialists in the far left. You know, it was Bernie or nothing. So I'm trying. I mean, I'm really struggling right now. And I wish that maybe if I didn't live in an area which was overwhelmingly progressive, I would be able to have these conversations.
And I think,
go ahead.
I think that we're weird because we opt into this. And so we're not like most of our friends. And so it's, so for people who aren't thinking about it or who aren't open to this kind of experience, it's much more difficult to say, to articulate the value of what it means to sit down with somebody that you disagree with.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that you can go through life seeing people as just a political party or a political ideology. I think one of the transformative moments for me was having a friend who's part of a group called Feminists for Life. And I was like, wait, that's a thing? Like, I didn't even, you're pro-life, but it's an organization. And, you know, having that conversation with her on why she believes what she believes, it was, that was really like, I'd never thought about it that way before. You know, so I just feel we've made so many steps backward, and I feel like it's going to take us a lot to move forward, but it's like the people like us that are kind of in this vocal minority who want to do this. I just wish more people wanted to do this.
Just say thank you, whatever, however you want to say goodbye.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, I really appreciate you wanting to sit down and have a conversation. Thank you so much. It means a lot.
Yeah, this was a really great opportunity, and I appreciate the conversation.
Good. Thank you, Amy.